Some people think life is a game of strategy, like chess. Author Annie Duke believes that life is more like poker because it frequently involves choices made with imperfect knowledge under severe time constraints. Her new book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts, analyzes how the skills learned at the poker table can be applied to challenges in real life. The book is published by Portfolio Penguin, and I'm so happy it brings Annie Duke to the show today. Hi.
Hi.
So tell me a little about your childhood. What got you into poker in the first place?
Let's skip past my childhood. I started off my life as an academic. I was getting my PhD in cognitive science at the University of Pennsylvania. I was studying specifically first language acquisition, but in general, how do you learn in uncertain systems? That was what my PhD work was on. Toward the end of it, as I was going out for job talks in order to go be a professor, I actually got sick. And the job market in academics is yearly. So once you miss a season, you have to wait until the next season. So now I'm recuperating from this illness that I had landed me in the hospital, and I know I can't now go out to interview for professorships until the next year. And in that time, I figured out, oh, guess what? Like, your National Science Foundation Fellowship doesn't follow you as you take a year off from academics, and so I needed money. And it was during that time that I started playing poker. So I started playing poker in 1992. In 1994, I turned pro.
Who taught you poker?
My brother. So my brother's a guy named Howard Lederer. He's an amazing poker player in his own right. By that time, he had actually already been a professional poker player for 10 years. So it's not so bizarre that when I called my brother up and said, I don't know, like, I'm taking this year off, I don't have any money, any advice for me? He said, well, you know, I'll mentor you and you can play poker for money. And in that year, you know, I remember I still have my ledger from that first month, and I made more money in that first month than I would have made certainly as a professor. But also, more importantly than the money, I remember so clearly, like, sitting down that first time I played poker and just saying, oh my gosh, like, this is everything that I was studying in this completely real world application, like this huge problem about decision making and learning when there's all this noise, there's luck and you can't see the other player's cards, and there's these issues of how you keep your emotions under control and how do you learn from the outcomes.
Wait, and so what were you studying again in the first place?
Cognitive psychology.
Okay.
So I was specifically looking at first language acquisition, which doesn't look like it would be particularly similar, but it's actually quite similar. Like, think about the problem for a little baby trying to learn their first language. There's all these noises flying around and they have to figure out which are words and which aren't. And even if they figure out which are words and they can pick that out of the sound stream, now you say some unknown word like Dax. And if I just said Dax in this room, I mean, what is it? Is it a thing? Is it like this pitcher here or this cup? Or is it a quality like green or soft? Or is it an action like point or speak or walk? Or here's a really hard one. What if it's a state of mind? Like, think. I mean, these are very hard problems. And how does the baby sort through that in order to learn from all of this feedback that they're getting when things are very, very uncertain and only sort of loosely connected? And so when I sat down at the poker table, I realized, oh my God, this is a really interesting and very similar problem. And I sort of felt like I had landed in this new laboratory to study what I was doing. So that year, which was supposed to be in the meantime before becoming a professor, turned into 20 years of in the meantime. I retired in 2012 and have since sort of wound my way back to academics. But it just took me a while. But I really love sitting in this kind of natural experiment.
And you think that there is a lot that you can apply from learning and succeeding at poker to day-to-day life.
So I think that it's such a great model for how to make good decisions in life. And that's not accidental. So there's this field in economics called game theory, which is actually the study of decision-making in economics. And for example, game theory is what drove like our Cold War strategy. That's where they came up with the idea of mutually assured destruction and that kind of thing. And that field in which there are many, many Nobel laureates in game theory. It's a prolific field for producing Nobel laureates. That field was actually sprung out of looking at a very stripped down version of poker. And the reason why I think poker makes such a good model for life's decision making is that it's exactly decision making under conditions of uncertainty. The uncertainty is coming from luck. And then also this hidden information, you don't know all the facts that you need in order to make a decision. So what it means is that the way that things turn out is loosely related to your decision quality. And you can compare that to something like chess. So chess, you can see where all the pieces are. So the hidden information is gone and there's actually very little luck. So for example, if you were to lose a game of chess to somebody, it would be a totally reasonable thing for me to say, well, you probably made some bad decisions in there. Like clearly, let's go back and look and see where your strategic errors were. And that's a completely reasonable thing to do in chess. It's actually quite unreasonable to do in poker. If you lose a hand, it doesn't necessarily mean that you made any bad decisions. So, and we can relate to that to some of the simplest decisions in life, like heading through an intersection. So if you run a red light, you're not guaranteed to get in an accident or even so much as get a ticket. You can get through totally fine. And that doesn't mean that you made a good decision. And you can go through a green light and get in an accident. So that's why we can think about poker as a much better model than a game like chess. If life were like chess, when you ran a red light, something bad would happen. And when you ran a green light, you would be just fine. But that's not the way it works. So, and you can imagine once you get to much more complicated decisions besides just sort of going through traffic lights that, you know, this problem kind of explodes on us.
Did you watch last night's game?
Of course, I'm from Philadelphia.
Oh, okay.
Hello. I went to graduate school in Philly. I have been, you know, since the Randall Cunningham days, man, I have been waiting for this.
So you're floating.
Yes. Well,
you're doing well.
I'm floating. And I would like to say I was at home, so I'm not responsible for any overturned cars. I just want to make that clear.
Okay. On the record.
On the record.
So were you watching this as a fan or were you watching it also as, you know, this author and expert, poker player?
Well, so I always watch it as a fan, but I also watch it. I'm always watching football from the standpoint of like, this is really interesting. I wonder, should they be going for this on fourth down? How much is it worth for them to go on fourth down versus, say, punt? Which is the better decision? When should you be going for two as opposed to just the extra point? If you miss an extra point, how does that change the percentages? I do definitely look at it that way.
But does this mean that you're the kind of person who has like data? Like you're actually looking at, wait, on fourth and sixth, you know, only 2% or whatever, one team has made this, you know, this pass or completed it, like, you know, this crazy amount of data that are you like absorbing that and disseminating it too?
So what I'm doing is there's a friend of mine and I will just text them and say, what was that fourth down play worth? Was that a good decision? So I think there was particularly one where the Patriots went for it on fourth and five, as I recall, and I was really interested in that. So I texted my friend who does have all that data to ask them whether they thought that was a good play or a good choice or a bad choice mathematically.
So you start the book by talking about a notorious decision made during the Super Bowl a few years ago. This is 2015. Pete Carroll was the coach of the Seahawks. What did he decide to do?
Well, actually, so in light of last night's game, I think that this is very timely because I think that we can see the two sides of the problem here. So let me explain what happened to Pete Carroll and the Seahawks. I'm sure everybody remembers because it's totally notorious. There are 26 seconds left on the one-yard line. They have one timeout. It's second down. Pete Carroll calls a pass play. Everybody's expecting him to call a running play and hand it off to Marshawn Lynch, obviously, you know, one of the greatest running backs ever. He calls a pass play, gets intercepted in the end zone. Patriots win the game. You know, they're down by, obviously, the Seahawks were down by four. So if they can just get it across the goal line, they're going to win. There's not enough time left.
Doesn't happen.
So the headlines the next day were completely brutal. I mean, it was just, you know, worst play in Super Bowl history. What was he thinking? There was one online site that called him an effing idiot. I mean, like, it was really awful. But I think that all we have to do is the thought experiment. And now I don't even have to give you the thought experiment because this happened last night. So I'm so excited because you see the other side of
this. We're here. Now. Let's do it.
So the thought experiment I would give you is, what if the play had been caught? But I can give you it from last night. So 4th and 1, the Eagles have obviously an easy field goal. They decide to go for it. They do this crazy play where Nick Foles is no longer the quarterback, right? Mm-hmm, and another guy takes the snap. Nick Foles sort of waltzes into the end zone. He catches the ball. And what is everybody saying today? That was an incredibly brilliant play. So this is literally the mirror image to what happened with Pete Carroll, except that obviously that wasn't an end of game play. And everybody's calling it brilliant. So let's just flip the script, right? So let's imagine that the Seahawks had caught the ball. And what do the headlines look like the next day? He's brilliant. He outsmarted Belichick. He beat him at his own game. And we know that's what they look like because that's exactly what they're saying about the Eagles today, you know, outsmarted Belichick. But had Nick Foles, had that gotten intercepted, obviously I think that they would have been really criticized for not just taking the field goal there last night, or had it been dropped, nobody would have thought twice about it. So the problem here is that in both cases, what's happening is we're doing something called resulting, which is taking the quality of the way that things turn out, the quality of the outcome, to derive the decision quality. In either case, you can just look mathematically at whether it's a reasonable play. And in both cases, it is mathematically a very reasonable choice that they made. But what you can see is that the reaction of the public to the play is very different based on whether it turned out well or whether it didn't. And what that means is that we're acting like we're playing chess as opposed to we're playing poker. Because if we were playing chess, that's reasonable. Like if you lose, it was probably some bad decisions.
So you're saying the problem is that people are conflating the two, or rather that they are unwilling to accept that there is an unknown aspect to a play?
Well, generally in life, as we're sort of looking at what outcomes have to teach us, we're very uncomfortable with the fact that bad things can happen even though you make a good decision. Like we connect outcomes and decision quality way too tightly. And we do this thing called resulting. We take the quality of the result and then we say, well, that tells us what the quality of the decision must have been. And when we do that too tightly, we can get in really big trouble. You can see this in the difference between the reaction to Pete Carroll and the reaction to Nick Foles. But I can tell you like a really simple example where you can see that we shouldn't have this tight connection. If let's say that somebody drove home after having a few too many and they happen to get home safely, one would hope that they don't think that that's a good decision because the result was good and that they should be now repeating that and driving home when they've had too many, right? Sure. Let's hope that they start taking a ride-sharing service, mm-hmm. right? So I can show you these examples that are very, very clear that show you that, well, you know, outcomes and decisions are only kind of loosely correlated, right? You can make very good decisions and sometimes things don't work out.
But in the case of, say, football, I mean, finally, people just care about whether their team wins or not, right?
Well, I agree. And there's a difference, though, between being sad that the play didn't work out and sad that your team didn't win and looking at the headlines the next day saying that Pete Carroll's decision-making was horrible. Whether that decision was good or not isn't determined by how it turned out on that one try. And to tell you what the statistics are, the chances of an interception there are only between about 1 and 2%. It's a very small chance of an interception. Most of the time, the ball gets caught, win the game, or dropped, clock stops, they get to hand it off to Marshawn Lynch twice, right? So, and what's interesting is that I think that you'll agree that if I said, well, what if he had caught it? I think we'd all be talking about how brilliant Pete Carroll was. So we need to separate out this feeling of, well, I'm sad that it didn't work out and I'm sad that my team didn't win, with, well, that means that he must have made a horrible decision. And therefore, what are you going to learn from that? That you shouldn't be calling that play on fourth down? Well, maybe that play was mathematically really good. That would be the equivalent of saying, I got home fine when I drove drunk, so I guess I should do that again.
So how do you decide when you've made a good decision when the outcome is bad?
So I think that there's a couple of things that we can do that can be really helpful for that. The first thing, and you need to get a good group of people around you who are really committed to deconstructing your decisions with you. I think the first thing to do is to realize, based on only one outcome, you can't tell that much, right? So it's the same, if I flipped a coin and you called heads, that doesn't tell you very much about whether you should call heads again the next time, right? So I think that we need to agree to that. And then there's two really good strategies for getting to decision quality and trying to sort of cordon yourself off so that the outcome doesn't distort it as you're trying to do that analysis. The first thing is, as much as possible, try to analyze your decisions in advance of getting the outcome, when possible. So as an example, if you're a trial lawyer, try to analyze your trial strategy prior to getting a verdict. That's one way that you can do it. Now, sometimes that's not possible. Obviously, in poker, it certainly isn't. The outcomes come too fast. In football, that's very hard. The outcomes come too fast. So the other way you can do it is find yourself a group of people to analyze the decision with who are quarantined from the outcome. They don't know the outcome of what you're trying to decide about, right? And describe the decision and what you were thinking about and what the mathematics of it were, what the options were, and don't tell them how it turned out. Then you're just going to get much higher fidelity advice about the decision quality from them because you won't have infected them with this resulting problem. Because once you tell them what the outcome is, they'll try to retrofit it. They'll try to make it make sense given that. So the more that you can do outcome blind analysis, essentially, the better off you are. And this is something that we can really borrow from even physics. They do this. So what they found in physics is that if I hand you a data set and I ask you to analyze it, and it seems like physics is pretty objective, it wouldn't have this problem, but it does. And Feynman, Richard Feynman, who's a pretty famous physicist, was the first person who figured out that there was an issue with this. And then a guy named Alvarez came along and figured out about outcome blind analysis. If I hand you a data set and you know what hypothesis I have, the way that you analyze that data set will actually be analyzed toward proving the hypothesis. So what they do in physics is they actually do what's called blind the data. They put in all sorts of stuff to make it so that really hard for you to figure out what the hypothesis is. And that way your analysis is much higher fidelity. So we can take from what scientists are doing and put that into our own decision-making life.
I've been speaking with Annie Duke, author and former professional poker player, about her new book, Thinking in Bets, Making Smarter Decisions When You Don't Have All the Facts. Annie, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.